The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 4th of June, 2020. On the podcast today, John Clark, CEO of Gfinity, G-F-I-N, sticker there, and John discusses their agreement with Abu Dhabi Motorsport Management to create a jointly owned new esports racing championship. Plus, Ciro Ciccone, CEO of Zaim Credit Systems, Z-A-I-M, sticker there. And Ciro provides a business update for the first quarter and outlook for the rest of the year. Also, Chris Bailey, founder of Financial Orbit, covers the FTSE 100 reshuffle and news from the following companies: EasyJet, Pennon, Fevertree Drinks, and IG Group. And John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about how government stimulus could be good for resource stocks. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. And also, check out, whilst you're there, at the homepage, voxmarkets.co.uk, our COVID-19 index. How many companies are there now? 28 companies rising at the top there at the moment is Gene Drive, GDR, up 6%. And at the bottom there is Novacyt, down 11%. And these are companies that sort of are well-placed to take advantage of the COVID-19 pandemic, or they're helping in the fight against the virus, they're creating tests, or they're just industries that benefit from the trend change, you know, that's been created by the lockdown. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Clark, CEO of Gfinity, G-F-I-N, is ticker there. John, thanks for joining me.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah, and you've announced a significant bit of news today. You and Abu Dhabi Motorsport Management, you've joined together to create a joint-owned new esports racing championship. And we'll dig into that and ask you about the significance of that in a bit. But as always, I mean, people have got a hint there of what you're about, but if someone has no idea what Gfinity is, can you just summarise the business, please?
Of course. Now, Gfinity is a world-leading esports and competitive gaming entertainment company. We work with some of the world's biggest and most respected brands, and including, as of today, as you mentioned, Abu Dhabi Motorsport Management, ADMM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And do you know what? It's a lot of money in the Middle East, and they seem to be latching on to this esports and all that stuff. Now, this partnership, like I said, ADMM is that stands for Abu Dhabi Motorsport Management. Can you give us a bit more detail on what's happening here?
Yeah, first, just to say a little bit more about ADMM. ADMM creates world-class and unique experiences. The F1 Etihad Grand Prix is a major event in the company's portfolio. You know, it delivers over 400 events a year at the Yas Marina in Abu Dhabi. And it also has a strategic focus to develop and invest in premium racing properties. And virtual racing is now becoming key to them. And I think that's important as we look at the story that we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. You know, we've announced a five-year partnership to create this new unique esports motorsport racing championship. Yeah, we're calling that the ERC, and this is jointly owned by ADMM and Gfinity. The ERC concept is based on a unique racing format that's not been seen before. It's going to be two seasons. The first will take place later this year. It'll involve world-class drivers and teams who'll be taking part. And importantly, again, it's been created with a broadcast audience in mind. So creating entertainment-based shows that gives a certain amount of hours that the broadcasters can use and enjoy. And I think what we've seen in this lockdown period is that more and more broadcasters have seen the value and the power of tapping into younger audiences through gaming. So that's what makes this exciting as well. So what we announced today is the partnership, and we look forward to sharing more details about the actual ERC in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, and these, you know, sort of esports events make so much sense, because, like I said, if you've got a stadium there and you fit, what, say, maximum 100,000 people in a stadium, you know, you can get multiples of that watching around the world, many multiples of that watching around the world, and you can still monetize that, I suppose. So it's very significant, isn't it? And I've noticed this is a partnership here you're talking about. You're not just providing services, it's a partnership. So why have they chosen you then to partnership with them?
Yeah, just before I go into that, I think this important point to make just is that the what we're talking about with them to start with is virtual gaming.
Yeah.
And so you can bring people around the world, play virtually and compete. And then rightly, you know, as this develops and evolves and as the situation changes around the world in which we're living in at the moment and encourages people to come together again, then that creates opportunities to bring live to sort of as well as online, to have offline opportunities as well. So I think that's what's exciting about that about the partnership that we've developed. But going back to, you know, why choose Gfinity? I think we've had unparalleled experience in virtual motorsport, and we've gained that experience through working with great brands like Formula One and with leading publishers like Codemasters and Microsoft, and sort of built and developed a real sort of knack of creating great entertainment-based products, utilizing our technical IP with something called race control for in-race adjudication, as well as great data flow about cars and performance and drivers that can be used to enhance the consumer experience. So I think that's one area of why it's unparalleled expertise. Second area is, and this is what's happened as we've spent time talking with the great ADMM team, is a shared passion for creating something new and exciting in the marketplace. And that's really what's driving the thinking here, is not to try and create something that's already there and just try and do it better. It's saying, okay, how do you create something completely different that's going to draw a massive audience of gamers, hundreds of millions of people that love gaming but also love motorsport, and giving them another opportunity to engage in something that they can be excited by. And so we have a sort of a shared passion and a meeting of minds in that, on that front. But it's also, when you look at the CEO of ADMM, Alturek Alamiri, he's sort of said that Gfinity is the right partner, and also the fact that there's more initiatives that ADMM and Gfinity will be creating together in the future. So this is a partnership. It's a 5-year vision of what can be achieved in the area of digital motorsport and virtual racing and physical events. So massive opportunity, big growth area, and two organizations, Gfinity and ADMM, that have significant complementary skills to do things that others may not be able to do.
Yeah. And what's the importance of this announcement in regards to your strategic plan for growing the business, and also just highlight your plan, if you could, the change?
Yeah, I think we've spoken before. One of the transitions for Gfinity has been to sort of find ways to move and transition from a service provision sort of dominated business into a business that has multiple sort of different revenue streams, some that we own, some that are partnerships, as well as some excellent partners of relationships with big companies like Formula One and the Premier League, that is great service provision and creating great products for them. So our focus is really been on evolving and that business model. So we've got three pillars. We've sort of focused on three pillars, and the goal is to go deeper into each one. First is our own community, which we own and monetize, 11 million users, and we created recently the Gfinity Digital Media Group to fully capture the advertising potential, but also the e-commerce opportunity in that space. Secondly, building community for others, utilizing our tournament platform, and looking really as a platform as a service type concept, as well as our world-class content production capability. And then the third area was that area of motorsport. And as we announced a couple of weeks back now, a multi-year Formula One esports deal was the largest in Gfinity's history, which is exciting to sort of take that product and premium product to new higher grounds. And now this opportunity and this partnership with ADMM was for a different type, a unique type of competition that we jointly own. So that's our ability to drive and dive into that space and go deeper and work with partners that are have a shared passion and a shared vision of what is possible is what's driving our growth in the motorsport area.
Yeah, and a month or so ago, you announced a partnership with Yala Esports, also in the Middle East and North African region, to build a gamer-focused website. So will this help your partnership with ADMM?
Yeah, definitely. I think that partnership was a great partnership for us because the region is one of the largest esports audiences in the world, but grossly underserved by local language content. And so the focus with that deal was to take our Real Gaming 101 website and start to convert that into Arabic, create local content and stories, working with local writers and gaming enthusiasts, and to sort of build a large engaged community of gamers and gamer fans. And so that process has been going very well. You know, the audience is growing, the site's doing incredibly well. That's going to create good commercial opportunities coming from that. And now, as we develop this relationship with ADMM, there is a natural vehicle that we have through Yala Esports to be able to talk to the gamer about the motorsport competition and the other things that they love and they enjoy learning about and playing. Mm-hmm. So you know, these are all related in one way or another to driving increased excitement, engagement, and participation in gaming in the region.
Yeah, and you know, I've noticed over the last, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months or so, there's been a steady flow of news coming out from Gfinity now. Is that a sign that, you know, the strategy refocus is starting to work?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing at the moment is through the announcements that we're making is a representation of the different business model that we have in place. You know, they would say we're looking to deepen. We're service provision for the biggest and the best brands with Formula One but then having a multi-year agreement rather than the one-year agreement as we've had in the past, with some commercial rights in the esports space. Doing great things for BT Sport to sort of broaden their appeal to gamers. The Premier League. Competitions and running those and demonstrating again through smart use of gaming and talent to create really entertaining shows. So I think that's one area that is growing and has benefited from the lockdown situation. With the announcement about the Gfinity Digital Media Group was a sign, the signal, I think, to advertisers and to brands that if you want to reach the hard to connect with gamer audience, then through Gfinity's 11 million users, there is a fast growing sort of organically built vehicle and vehicles that people can tap into, whether it's through our Gfinity esports, or whether it's our stealth optional site for gamer tech, or whether it's for the real sport 101 for more casual gaming enthusiasts. There is now platforms of which to reach that audience that's highly effective. So and that area, as I mentioned, it was 100% owned by Gfinity. And then there's this joint partnership, joint ventures and partnerships area where, you know, we create great ideas, great concepts, and then find partners that are like-minded to help bring them to life. And I think that's what you're seeing today with the announcement about ADMM. So at each level of our business, we're seeing growth, and we are seeing an evolution of our model to reflect more revenue coming from the areas of what we own and through joint venture partnerships.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, John, well, as always, if someone is listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making with your new strategy, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Of course. Right. Firstly, we're well positioned in a fast moving industry segment. Secondly, this business now has multiple revenue streams that are all starting to fire. And thirdly, the goal and the plan is that we'll be break even by the year end and moving into profitability at the end of Q1 2021.
Excellent stuff. John, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Justin. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ciro Ciccone, CEO of Zaim Credit Systems, ZAIM. AIM is the ticker there. Ciro, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin, for inviting me, and very happy to be here.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, listen, you've released a first quarter update, a trading update of late, and we'll dig into that in a bit. Before we do, as always, Ciro, if someone's listening right now, I've never heard of the company, just explain what it does, please.
Okay, so Zaim is a fintech platform operating microfinance and microloans in Russia. We have 7 years' experience. We provide small loans. Average size is around 19 to 95 pounds for a duration which is 30 to 40 days to unbanked or unbankable people. We work on this market from the day one of the incorporation, which is goes by back to 7 years ago, and we are growing steadily and healthy from a few years already.
Yes, excellent stuff. Okay, so based in Russia, you did a first quarter trading update, and of course the world is changing every week due to coronavirus, COVID-19, you know, economies are reopening, so of course, even though this is first quarter, we're moving on a bit now, but take us through some of the highlights, if you could, from the quarter one, Ciro. Yeah,
sure. So, quarter one was rather good. We were very happy because it was a bit better, slightly better of our expectations. But it was before the COVID. As I told you in my previous podcast, in beginning of April, Russian authorities released a lockdown regime for the entire country as well as Europe. How did we face it? Let me say that given the European experience, we decided to anticipate the move, and Zaim was already operating on, let's say, COVID regime from 2 weeks before the lockdown was in Moscow. So the team was working in a smart working mode. We reduced the flow of clients in the stores. We gave to stores very strict rules, behavioral rules and regulations. And we have made a very strong renegotiation of the fees for the rental and the fixed costs. So basically, we have anticipated the move, and this put us in a very, let me say, not very comfortable, but a reasonable condition of facing going through this period. The lockdown is being released. In these days, the authorities have lifted part of the rules. Now, most industrial plants and work sites are restarting, and people are going back to work and restarting their, let's say, consumption and financial needs to as previous of as it was previous before the COVID, and we expect the complete lifting of the lockdown by the end of this month. But at the moment, as I told you, we, given the decisions we have taken before the lockdown was released, we are in a very comfortable position because we have a good liquidity, good cash position, and a very safe business structure. We wait for the situation to finish, and then we will start pushing again on the growth.
Excellent stuff. And so what kind of growth do you expect to achieve there in Russia?
Well, we expect or we hope that COVID will be a parenthesis that will cut 3 months from our plan. So we will we hope to achieve the growth as we have forecasted, significant growth on year to year basis, both in terms of volumes and profitability. I think I can give you maybe more detailed view on this on our next podcast. Again, I think that COVID is will be a parenthesis that has cut 3 months from the plans. Or at least we hope it will be like this.
Yeah, understood, because, you know, there are so many businesses at the moment who are unable to give any forward guidance because, of course, we don't know exactly how soon the economy will be lifted and, you know, to what extent, how much of the economy will be back open and how fast will be back open, you know?
Absolutely, yeah, I totally agree. Moreover, what we can see is a very, very early stage because the few improvements, the very initial improvements on the conditions are like 3-4 days, 5 days ago. So it's too early to make an assessment. Yeah. What I can see, what I can tell you about is just personal expectation or management expectations. I would prefer to give you more detailed sensations, more solid sensation next time. What I can tell you is that irrespectively of the recovery curve, we are in a very good cash and financial position. Mm-hmm. So we can wait. Yeah. We expect before COVID, we were operating in a booming market with very good expectations. At the moment, market of course is dropping because consumptions and the rest of the economy is down. But we think it will be a limited parenthesis for 2 to 3 months.
Okay, all right. Well, listen then, Ciro. In the meantime, people listening to the story likes the sound of what you're talking about here and you know, the resumption of the economy there, reopening in Russia, but are not yet following the story. Please give them 3 reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list.
I'm very glad to do so. So, reason one. We are operating in a booming market, both in Russia and all over the world. Providing financial services to unbanked people is a basic need for all countries in the world, all areas in the world. We are very resilient. We have shown a good resilience to the troubles. Companies operating has gone through difficult moment in 2014-2015, regulations tightenings. So company is expert and very resilient, very flexible organization and business model. And third reason is we are very expert. We know how to run the business, we know our business, and we know how to make it profitable. So these are the 3 reasons. Booming market, resilience, mm-hmm. and experience.
Excellent stuff, Ciro. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin, and look forward to talking to you again. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Very well. I mean, given the markets, of course, I'm ecstatic, but I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, well, you know, you are quite fully invested, aren't you? So it's been a heck of, you know, so I mean, I was going to say it's been a good bounce, but is it a bounce? That's the thing. No one really knows now. It's got to the stage where I think, do you know what my take on it is this? There's too many bears out there still, and until people are convinced by it, we won't have a sell off. And that's the thing, you know.
I think that's absolutely right. And we all know the short-term role of psychology and sort of how voters, sort of investors are thinking and everything else. And so my feeling would be very similar. When I look at the sentiment indices, we haven't yet reached extreme greed. We're moving closer towards there, clearly. But we've been walking up that wall of worry for the last couple of months. And so I think the moment, my instinct is we'd probably go higher. But I think within that, what I'm observing, and it's kind of driven a little bit by obviously healthcare trends and confidence about growth levels, but other things such as the lower dollar and stuff like that, I'm seeing a bit more enthusiasm for a broader range of stocks, not just sort of tech-centric or sort of ultra-defensive healthcare names or COVID-19 linked names, a broader set of stuff which is a bit more cyclical, a bit more industrial, a bit more commodity-centered, you know. And I think that's healthy for the markets per se, but it's certainly helpful in terms of giving a slightly sort of deeper drive to the underlying sort of indices. So I think that's right. I think at the moment, you're right, I am effectively fully invested. I think when the full disclosures, I've got the Whitbread rights issue monies. I think they're due in a week or so. Once they go in, you know, literally my cash balance will be not a lot. You know, probably about 1% of my SIP. So yeah, I am fully invested, but thoughtful as always, and thinking about, well, okay, when do I take some chips off the table? But yeah, my instinct today is it's not quite at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I'm at opposite end. I mean, I'm only a third invested, but I intend to sort of invest more on any more drops. And I'm not, you know, like I said, and the thing is, the way I look at it is this: whether this we've seen the big bounce or not, I don't mind too much, because if you look at it once a year, there's a healthy correction. Now we've had this big one this year, so it may not happen, but I can't see us having no volatility for the rest of the year, because this will be quite a turbulent month, or quite a turbulent next couple of quarters as far as earnings are concerned. So I think we will have more volatility, you know. I think that's pretty much nailed in, isn't it? Nailed on.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you think about some of the other events. Even if we you know, we can't put aside the coronavirus, clearly the data does look a little bit better, and that's good. But you're absolutely right, the economic bounce back is not nailed on. There's going to be a lot of adjustment pain, unemployment issues and related, the impact of that on consumer markets, the property market and whatnot. And then of course we've got other curveballs, be it US presidential election. You know, in any other year, we'd be talking about that as the key macro kind of event, and that's obviously less than 6 months away. Brexit is still, you know, rumbling around in the background and everything else. So there's a myriad of other issues still out there. Markets are going to be volatile. They tend to be over the summer. Remember last summer, they were volatile then. Trump stirred the pot on trade and the markets were very volatile in July and August. Ultimately bounced back, but certainly you and I talked about it at the time. It caused investors a lot of heartache and sort of internal searching. So lots of things to be thinking about. Absolutely. Keep close to your companies, keep watching the prices, keep thinking, keep over the news flow, and that's all you can do, really.
Yeah. Just the NASDAQ chart there, literally, it hit yesterday. What was the close there? 9682, and that was very close to 9817, the high of February, to the highest ever high it's ever hit, you know. So it's an odd thing to bounce back there. Obviously, yeah, there's a lot of tech stocks in that, but I mean,
there is, and this is why I think a broadening of the market is the healthy thing. I mean, we've seen in the last few days where the NASDAQ has underperformed sort of in the States, sort of some of the broader indices, Dow and S&P, and obviously that plays into other global indices, be it the FTSE, be it Europe, be it Asia, or other places, which don't quite have that sort of massive tech weighting to the same degree, and are kind of driven a bit more by, as I said, they're sort of that kind of cyclical industrial commodity sort of grouping a bit more. So watch that, and I think that's why at this moment in time I'm not taking my chips off the table, but I'm certainly very thoughtful about it, and certainly in an individual stock level there are some names which are getting no doubt closer to where I'm thinking, okay, you know, perhaps time to take a few chips off the table and think again.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about, you mentioned pain earlier on, of course airlines and all that felt the pain. I saw that they every now and again they swap their FTSE constituents based on the size of the market cap, of course. Who's in, who's out?
Yeah, it's a big reshuffle this time. They sort of announced it just earlier this week, and it'll actually be enacted a little bit more towards the middle of June. But we've certainly seen the influence of the coronavirus. I mean, you've had EasyJet drop out, you've had Carnival Cruises drop out, you've had Centrica drop out. You know, Centrica's obviously been beaten up a bit more by governments and other stuff. So, you know, there's been some overt sort of impacts from that sort of thing. By contrast, what's coming in is it's an interesting sort of mix, really. You've got stuff like HomeServe. You know, it's kind of interesting where HomeServe, with that kind of repetitive sort of subscription kind of insurance style services, yeah, recurring around boilers revenue, and other stuff. Recurring revenue, indeed, that's come in. And Centrica, which is, in another way, is another recurring revenue, but obviously one where perhaps barriers to entry have become a little less solid, and certainly where there's much more influence in terms of things like government policy, price caps and regulation, whatever, that's dropping out. You know, that's a very interesting sort of switch. Anyone who called that one in terms of a few years ago was long one and short the other, well done, because that would have been a very wise and successful investment. Got a couple of others coming back in, things like GVC, which I do like, in the betting zone. Obviously, they're benefiting from things such as online taking up where the physical stores, obviously, which have generally been closed. And obviously online they can do a broader range of stuff than just football and horse racing, which is coming back in any case. So GVC is back in, and Kingfisher's back in. Now, that's an interesting one, because that's a retailer. Who would have thought a retailer comes back in? But of course, other stuff's perhaps been even more impacted. And the thing about Kingfisher, is being Q is obviously their key brand, is it is an important player in what they do, very, very, very clearly number one. But you know, in a weird way, we're all at home, or many of us are at home. Things like DIY, once the DIY stores opened, the nice weather, that's sort of a combination those companies sort of like. And Kingfisher actually is a survivor. They've got a decent balance sheet in the wider scheme of things. So they're going to come back in.
Yeah, and you know, when you get demoted, you get a bit of selling, of course, from hedge funds. I suppose this already probably happened, because they probably know what's going on. But then there was a stat I saw, I was trying to find it, I couldn't see it, that generally companies that drop out of the FTSE do quite well, because obviously all the selling's happened and it's all dried up, and people see them as a bit of a recovery play, a bargain. I think there's like a outsized returns to be had on companies that generally drop out of that. I don't know if I'm making that up.
Yes. But, I think you're absolutely right. I would completely agree. I remember back in my days as an institutional investor, we were always much more interested in the ones dropping out than the ones coming in. The only exception to that is when you've got what I would call a regime change, where there's a company which is suddenly kind of not just sort of coming up on the rails, but actually is just doing something which propels it from small cap to mid cap to FTSE 100. I must admit, I've got to spend a little bit of time on this sort of internet security company, Avast, which is coming into the FTSE 100. Well, this is it. Neither do I. You know, I sort of know what they do. I see their name on various sort of computer programs or in the background on various things. I've got to do some work on it. It's an intriguing background. They've got big facilities in in Central Europe, in bits in the Middle East. There's a strange ownership structure. You know, I've got to get all over this, because it's coming into the FTSE. Why, how, you know, where's it going? That's a good debate. So certainly that was the one this time around. I know GVC, well, I own it. I know Kingfisher, well, Avast, you know, that's kind of an intriguing one. You know, what should I be thinking? So, but generally you're right. You know, stuff that falls out, to be honest, it's not quite as extreme as it used to be. I think the trackers have got a lot more kind of sensible about this. But certainly if you looked at the EasyJet share price, let's say, and you would say, well, this one's just dropped out the FTSE, you're dropping out the FTSE, you wouldn't notice it, because the share's gone from 4 or 5 quid a few weeks ago to pushing 7 and change at the moment, and that's all to do with the external world and changes and hope and everything else, and absolutely nothing to do with the fact that a few trackers have had to sell it. So it's as always, you've got to put these things into context. So big old changes in the FTSE 100 composition.
Yeah, cool. Okay, any news out there, Chris, worth chatting about?
Well, you've got some bits and bobs of news. I'll tell you one which also flies a bit under the radar, and that's Pennon. Pennon is a water and waste company, and you'd be forgiven for ignoring it, but you look at the chart of Pennon, it's kicking around all-time highs. And there's two reasons for that. Of course, we all know one of them, which is water and waste is a chugger industry. You know, it's something which we sort of need, and it's not very exciting, but sometimes not exciting can be remunerative over a longer haul. And obviously, the things like the coronavirus do not impact it as much. The other reason is because they actually did a deal to sell their waste division a few months ago to private equity for a song, you know, for a very good price. And can you imagine, that deal still seems to be on. It's set to complete in the summer. So what they're going to get is a big old chunk of their market cap back as cash. They'll pay down debt. They'll sort out their pension fund, make that even stronger, and they'll divvy return some cash back to shareholders. So people are probably in this one just because it's in a safe-ish area, and it's got a safe sort of underlying story in terms of its balance sheet and its recent corporate activity. So long as that deal holds, that's actually the reason I wouldn't hold it, to be honest, because it's completely loved up. It's certainly reasonably firmly valued for what it is, and if that deal ever did fall apart, I've got no suggestion that it is, but you never know in today's world, then the shares would certainly come back rapidly. So Pennon came up with some very solid and, you know, to be honest, quite boring comments, but you know, that's what people hold the stock for. Talking about a 2% increase in the dividend per annum between 2020 and 2025, which in an era obviously of dividends being cut or suspended or whatever else, will appeal to some people. So if you're after a lot of stability, bond-esque sort of stability, then maybe Pennon's your area. But to be honest, I think there's more exciting things for me to look at in the market.
I know what you mean, but you know, it's rallied strongly since when is it? October last year. Pretty much it went from was it in that range. It wasn't going above eight quid, and then all of a sudden it broke out of 8 quid, and then went to up to 12 quid like that. So it's up there now. So
Well, that deal they announced was, you know, it's a cracking multiple. That 16 times EV EBITDA or something. You know, you're going to buy the handle of private equity for that sort of multiple. And waste businesses are nice, you know, for many reasons. They're linked a bit with recycling. They're linked with the fact that it's right and proper that both industrial and other waste should be processed well and everything else. It fits into a few mega themes out there at the moment, but hence the big price private equity paid. But I think I would personally leave Pennon shares a little bit alone today and look elsewhere. But if you've been holding them for the last little while, I'm sure you view it a little bit differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other news there, Chris?
Well, got to do a quick one on IG Group.
Hang on a second. As I was talking there, these are EasyJet. I just had an alert on them, a price alert, saying their price has just hit 70, which is on the RSI, which is a momentum indicator. That's heading towards overbought. So it's rallied. It's up to 8.19. It'll be back in the FTSE before you know it, surely.
This is it. You know, people have been listening to our conversation on the basis that stocks that have fallen out the FTSE are a bit more interesting, because you can bet there were some people kind of saying, hang on, there's going to be some big tracker selling, and now that this risk has passed, we're now going to buy it. To be honest, it's probably some headlines saying that there's going to be an air bridge with Portugal or other places that they fly to over the summer. I think EasyJet are up to about, they're talking about 70-75% of their flights, of their sort of normal schedule, they believe will be back on by the end of the summer. So, you know, they might not be full. There's clearly a whole load of other challenges, Stelios lurking in the background and whatever. But yeah, certainly the optimism around the stock has improved. And the same with IAG, you know, the renamed British Airways.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous. Sorry, there's other news there.
Well, we're going to quick one on IG Index, because again, it's a bit like Pennon. Their share price is a bit like Pennon's. It's kind of kicking around all-time highs, and that's kind of striking, because the reason why is because of all the volatility we've been talking about. A spread rating company can often do rather well in that period. People are trying to do things with their portfolio. I'm sure there's people listening to this now who are, you know, have IG accounts and use their services among all the other ones out there. And that's all fine. You know, that's maybe why such investments might be good at these times. But I must admit, I'm still I'm still struggling a bit because we all know that how the stats look, that what is it, sort of 70-80% of investors, people who have accounts, lose money. Mm. And you know, that's tough. That's a tough business to keep getting and finding new customers for, to be honest. So I haven't invested in this one for many a year, but fully acknowledge that they've done a good job in terms of facilitating people's willingness to do trades and have positions in hedge volatility or embrace volatility in these excitable markets.
Yeah, and I saw a graph tweeted out yesterday about, you know, is it Robin Hood, I think, this online app, the spread betting app or investment app in America, and millennials are finding it very popular with them because in the lockdown they've done nothing else to do apart from they started to spread bet, maybe trying to earn a bit of money on the side. Everyone just thinks it's very easy to earn money here at spread betting or stocks and shares. And it's almost the share price of obviously that NASDAQ, S&P have gone higher. And also, it's pretty much in line with the amount of accounts that have been opened on this Robinhood app. So if we do have a sell-off, I think you get a lot of panic sellers who are quite inexperienced and may even trigger some frantic selling everywhere. So, it's interesting. It's volatility. And also, in comparison with the lockdown, you've seen a very big interest in this area. But I think that's a catastrophe waiting to happen, really.
Yeah, no, I would certainly on IG shares per se. It's not one I'm considering. It seems firm enough for what it is. Good luck to them on their recent numbers, and obviously optimistic looking forward. But yeah, I think in a weird way, if volatility abates a little bit, or as you say, you go from good to bad volatility, then things could look a bit different. Yeah. One other one I just wanted to quickly mention that came up with some comments today was Fevertree. Now, Fevertree has been, it's actually an AIM company, quite a big AIM company, actually a couple of billion market cap. But, everyone knows what Fevertree is, the superior tonic, wherever they market themselves, and amongst other things. It's an interesting one. They came up with some comments today ahead of an AGM statement saying that, unsurprisingly, the on-trade has been really hit because things such as pubs and restaurants are closed. No surprises there. But the off-trade, the kind of the supermarkets, the convenience stores, and online, of course, has not fully offset, but certainly has made a contribution, a bigger contribution than they would have thought, in terms of sales uplift and everything else. So I noticed the shares have certainly been quite firm over recent weeks and months. I think there's a general perception that this one is a quality growth company. Clearly, it got very, very excitable a couple of years ago, where people were thinking it was going to take over the world effectively, and it seems to me they've got big market share in the UK. They're struggling to grow very sort of much more than kind of broader GDP trends now in the UK, but where their big hopes are still are in the States, a little bit in Europe, and sort of wider in the rest of the world. And certainly, I think, judging by recent comments from them, those hopes are still there. It's a product which is light, it's a slightly premium product, but it's got a good story, savvy marketing and sponsorship and stuff like that. Big old multiple, not quite as big as it was a couple of years ago, but certainly a perception that ultimately it may well be a fit for a Diageo or a Pernod or somebody like that in their even broader portfolios. So one to keep watching. I think it's quite rich at the moment in terms of valuation and tactical share price. But you've got to say, it feels like a company with a good culture, a cracking balance sheet, net cash on the balance sheet, over 100 million quid of net cash on the balance sheet. And I think a sort of a product, an aspirational product, which where I think they've got barriers to entry. So, yeah, interesting times for Fevertree.
Well, do you know what? When analysts look at companies and stocks, of course, you can do sensible sort of valuations and forecasts. But what they never, obviously, it's impossible to capture, it's just momentum. And when, people start raving about a stock and people start buying it and people get fear of missing out and buy it more and it drives the price higher, more people buy and people are thinking, oh, it's gone too high, then jump in and you get this rolling ball of momentum. And see, that's what's happened there. It was a darling, wasn't it, of the stock market. It went from, look at the dates here, it went from 2015, it was down at literally IPO'd at 125 or something like that, and they went for 40 yep. quid in 2000, yeah. end of 2018, and now it's, I think reality's got to the stage where reality sets in. The people who've made multiples start selling, the people who held it early on start selling because they've got big chunks of it, and then that creates a, you know, avalanche then of sellers, and you get reverse momentum then, or momentum the other way, and it's gone back down. You went back down to sort of 7 quid, but nevertheless, that kind of momentum in a stock, you get that every now and again, and it can happen at IPOs because not a lot of stock available sometimes, is there? And you know, who knows where it stops, but you can't predict that. You know, it doesn't matter how good an analyst you are, you can't predict that kind of stuff. And if you happen to be on one of those plays, then just hold on for a while. But it's like the thing with ASOS and all these right moves and all these companies have done that. You know, it's very few people, will, apart from maybe, you know, the board of directors or whatever, or the founders, will actually hold stock from the bottom right to the top. And probably it's actually down again anyway, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the reality is that with something like a Fever Tree, it's all about what they, how much you discount where they may be going. And, you know, you do, they've got, you know, their big competitor in the UK is Schweppes, obviously. Yeah. That's the other well-known mixer and supermarket brands and whatever else. And so you do the maths and you see what market share they've got in the UK, and that looks pretty solid and steady. It's never going to be much higher, but it's probably not going to go much lower. It's a good branded business. And so the question then is, could they replicate that to some extent in Europe? Looks like it. And the States, quite possibly as well. And unsurprisingly, particularly the States, that market in absolute terms is even bigger. So you can get very, very excited. And it's just a question how quickly you get excited. You know, where could they be in, say, 2025? And how do you discount that back? And unsurprisingly, events happening, you know, swing that around, be it coronavirus disruptions or be it, you know, another stuff going on. So it's certainly, all I'll say is, it looks a well-run company. It's got a good balance sheet and a good product. That's not a bad combination. And it's got some good growth potential. Now, what you price that at is another question. My personal view is at 20 quid, that's firm. Below 15, that's a bit more interesting. And obviously, you know, even lower numbers than that, all other things being equal, even more interesting. So I put a flag of 15 on this one, to be honest, because I think at that level, you'd say, right, do you want to put some new capital, initial capital into it? That might be interesting. You know, multiples will still be high, but when you sort of match up the potential versus the short-term multiples, maybe there's an angle. You know, we'll see. Maybe it never goes back there. Maybe it just continues to romp and, you know, the Americans absolutely get it over the next couple of years. We're never going to get that opportunity. But a bit of discipline, a bit of rationale and kind of revising your plan as new information comes in, that's all you can do. And if you miss it, you miss it. There'll be something else. You know, you don't worry about, you can't get everything. You can't invest in everything. You can't do everything. You just got to place your chips, think carefully about it, keep on revising your view and just go from there.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about the price, and sometimes you miss some and that's it. But then there'll be another one along very soon. And I say, you can't chase prices, because at the end of the day, if you buy too high, you know, you're not going to earn any money, you're going to lose money. You know? So,
as the great John Paul Getty apparently once said, you know, when asked how to be rich, he said, by selling too soon. Yeah. And that is absolutely right. You know, sometimes you can't, I mean, sort of new investors, and sometimes, of course, they do it where they buy at the bottom and sell at the top. But I can tell you, in too many years now of looking at this, of course, occasionally I have done that or got very close to doing that. Yeah. But most of the time, it's about that middle bit. You know, you're not going to get quite in at the bottom. It may well have advanced a number of many percent from the bottom. But what matters is that bit that you trade, which is consistent with your plan, your rationales, your risk profile, and everything else. And yeah, I never forget those Getty lines. You know, that's how you get rich, by selling too soon. We all know that a really bad portfolio is one which has a chock-a-block with minus 60% and minus 80%, and that's because, you know, people haven't haven't had that discipline to actually sell the losers as well.
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous stuff. Anything else there, Chris?
No. I think we've
covered everything. We've covered everything, exhausted everything.
Markets, FTSE, and various stocks. Now what we need is the latest coronavirus data and the Donald to remain suitably on message.
Yeah, well, you can catch that on Twitter. He's always on there. Marvellous stuff. Cheers, Chris. We'll speak to you next week.
Sounds a plan. See you then.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and part at SP Angel. You're right, John.
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Here's the thing, right? Now, everyone's discussing this, and I have a thought on it, about the markets and Main Street. You know, Wall Street, Main Street, there's the divergence here, or the divorce. It seems like Wall Street is very much in a divorce from the reality of the economic situation right now. A lot of people point to the fact that the Fed is dropping in, you know, 100 billion, pretty much 200 billion a week in stimulus to the markets. That's helping, of course. But of course, you have like the big industries as well. Like the, I just tweeted out today, actually, the S&P 500, 500 stocks in that. And but the FANG stocks plus Microsoft make up 22% in market capitalization of that index, and they're doing quite well. So even the S&P looks like it's doing well. There's a lot of companies not in there doing that well. So there's lots of different. It's not as black and white as we see, is it? There's things going on in the background. But also, this is my thing. A lot of people are bearish, and a market will not fall when everyone's bearish because everyone's pretty much sold. Everyone's got cash on the sidelines waiting for it to drop. Now, the market will not drop if there's no sellers because people have already sold. So that's the problem, isn't it? People have to get a lot more bullish for the market to become bearish, you know?
Well, we're seeing that hedge funds are becoming more cautious. And we know that hedge funds make a certain amount of their money out of shorting things down. And I think the environment is a little bit uncertain in terms that, yes, we have got lower economic growth staring at us, but that lower economic growth is really in the form of specific industries that have been hit very hard by the coronavirus, whilst certain other industries actually are recovering very, very well. So looking at data from China, from Alibaba, they see much stronger online sales.
The company,
for
not the
fruit
man,
juice. Yeah, the company. Yeah, they see strong sales for domestic appliances. People are working at home, so more from home. So they've got to have bigger fridges, bigger freezers. They're buying new ovens, all the bits and pieces that people are looking at in their kitchens going, well, that's, you know, we could upgrade that. And they're doing it because maybe they're worried that there may be another lockdown, maybe just thinking, oh, we're going to have to do more work from home going forwards, and we're trying to avoid crowds in commuting. And, you know, people are thinking, how do they manage their lives going forwards? And that causes them to go out and buy stuff. And that's a sort of stimulus thing in itself. And the governments are going to do their bit, because governments are going to add, according to our tally, $15 trillion worth of stimulus. And a load of that is going to end up in the form of construction projects. They're going to have to. The UK has mass public transport, and maybe this is why we got hit quite hard by the coronavirus early on. Was because lots of people may have been catching this on the tube, and it's quite hard to socially distance on a tube carriage which has got 1,000 people in it. Yeah. So things have to change. People will buy more cars in order to travel into London. Of course, the mayor has upped the congestion charge the low emission charge, so people will be buying more electric vehicles, and all these things require metals.
Yeah. Well, you have to buy stuff. But you know what? You're right. There are certain industries that will not recover very quickly, if at all. You know, like we're going to have struggling industries like the airline industry. Also, you know, hospitality industry. I don't know if you saw that report. Was it 2 days ago? There's 20,000 cinemas in China, right? They reckon 40% of them may close. So that's around about, 5,000 cinemas. Because President Xi Jinping said, if you want to watch a film, apparently recently said, do it at home. And so people are not going to cinemas, because that's obviously in close proximity to other people is where a chance it could flare up again. So there's certain industries going to suffer. But like I say, building stuff is the way forward. And I'm thinking, maybe if you can't go by flight, maybe you can just build bridges from one country to another country. That would take up a lot of construction workers, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And there are projects around the world and proposals to do things like that. So more channel tunnels. When you talk about cinemas, let's have more drive-in cinemas. That means more people are going to want to buy more cars so they can go and sit there and watch films. People still want to go out and do stuff.
Yeah, but in the UK, John, you'd have to have your windscreen wipers on. You couldn't see the screen in our cinema. In America, where it's nice, it's fine. But in our country, it wouldn't work, would it?
Well, I think people will still go and do it, frankly. Yeah. Because everybody wants to get out and do stuff. It's just that they've got to do stuff in a socially distanced manner. And a theatre or a cinema doesn't work terribly well where everyone's squashed in. Unless you're lucky enough to have your own box or something like that. So stuff will be built because there will be a demand for it. And people will be planning it right now.
Cinema pods.
Exactly.
I'm just thinking then, could you have a drive-in cinema with a covered area, like massive, drive-in, almost like, like ferries, you drive on ferries, but with a style of a cinema. But then I thought, hang on, that's a bit complex, isn't it? Maybe you just have, in cinemas now, you just create little pods so you're not breathing, and they're always cleaned, and I don't know, who knows.
There will be ways of reorientating our lifestyle if the coronavirus is to become a long-term feature. Personally, I think the virus will burn itself through and become a lesser thing. And one way or another, life will return to normal. I think, there are going to be businesses that go bust, but then new businesses will come out of the ashes of those companies. So with the airlines and things like that, and that will take probably two or three years, but that's just the way it's going to work, because governments are clearly not going to bail out every single low-cost airline that ever existed.
Yeah, but trouble is, if you've got this lower demand, it starts off with, we don't know, like I said, we're seeing scary figures coming out of America. You're unemployed. Now, initial claims are scary, but we've seen in fact, in the last week, 3 million went back to work. Of the total, which is about 41 million that now claimed jobless, initial jobless, but 3 million have gone back to work in 1 week. So that's good, actually, because that's gone down a tick. But we don't know the level of demand that will drop, because of course if you're out of work, you don't go to the shops or don't go to restaurants or cinemas that often, and so that side of it, you only spend on essentials. So at the moment it's an unclear picture, isn't it, how many are unemployed and how long that unemployment will last for.
You're absolutely correct, and this is what the funds are worried about. But at the same time, where else, if there is spare cash in the system, and where else are you going to put that money? And the governments are going to pump more cash into the system as well. So money, I think, is focusing on equities. If you want to buy an oil stock, you saw Shell cutting the dividend, which has helped that, has pushed that stock further down. So people are worried about that sort of news flow, and the oil price has a certain amount of uncertainty attached to it at the moment. So if we look at different sectors, there are, even a sector which I thought would be very good and for recovery, like oil, is struggling to get there. But if you look at the miners, which in many respects shouldn't do so well in an environment where we go into a lower GDP, lower economic growth scenario, but actually iron ore prices are at record levels in China. Other metals prices are rising. Everything seems to be recovering. And actually, if you look at Rio Tinto, BHP, of all the companies that are around the street, these companies look like they're best set with their dividends in many respects, because the huge earnings that will come off higher iron ore prices will feed through into those dividends.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got to be, but are you quite bullish, John?
I feel optimistic. I feel there is recovery here. I feel there's more money coming into equities. I've gone fully into equities on my own portfolio, and I've bought a few miners, and I've bought a few oil stocks, and a few house builders, and I think that's the way to go, because I think that, you know, it's the job of politicians, and yeah, they're voted in to serve the people, and the people want to recreate growth. We want to get over this situation, and we want to start building things again. And let's face it, if you look around the UK and many other countries in the world, there is a big need for upgrading infrastructure and recreating stuff. And I think longer term, people are not going to be happy about being squashed into tube carriages and crammed into buses and stuff like that. They're going to say, no, we need a bit more space. The coronavirus is not the only virus in the world. There are influenza, flu viruses, and no doubt a few things that we don't know about. And you know, people are going to say, no, we need a more healthy environment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, what I do agree with there is that we do need a healthy environment, but the government, they have been voted in by the people. The people, you know, generally, what if you look at an average human life for 80 years, you know, you can't live in misery, economic misery, all those lives. It's there for the government. If they need to, just get a bond going that's worth a couple of trillion, spread it over 200 years, because the government will always be here, but people's lives won't. So you've got to make the money available to stimulate the economy, to let people go to work. You know, we're not talking about freeloaders, we're talking about people who actually get up and go to work through no fault of their own, been dealt a really, you know, tough hand here. And so the government are there in these kind of situations to help the people, aren't they? You know?
And they will, you know. I mean, I know they people refer to the politicians as the liberal elite, and some of them really act that way. But at the end of the day, if they don't do something about this, they'll get voted out. So it's in everybody's interest to do this, and they'll issue government bonds, and what they do is they'll twist the arms of certain banks to put money into these bonds, but then they'll make it easy for them by saying, oh well, you can lend extra money on the back of these bonds. And so there are ways that they can effectively create money out of nothing. Yeah, that is inflationary ultimately, but you know, we've been in a deflationary environment for many years now, caused by China reducing the cost of goods, that very largely due to that. And I think that a bit of inflation is not a bad thing for the world. So this is actually good for metals prices. This is particularly good for gold, and we've seen a very strong gold price in recent weeks. And yes, it's good for many of these mining companies.
Yeah, and to be honest, right, I think the British government's response to coronavirus in its entirety has been quite poor, but the economic side of it, I think, has been quite good. And I think that's the shining light there. The rest of it, testing the PPE, even right now, you know, the guidelines of lockdown be very unclear, very confusing. But Rishi Sunak and the economic package, I think to this day, has been quite good, I think. And hopefully it'll continue to help. Well, they have to, you know, otherwise the economy goes down the tubes, the government takes less taxes, and everyone's up the spout. So it's in it with everyone's interest to get the economy going and working, isn't it, you know?
Well, look, people who are close to the government tell me that Boris Johnson is Boris Johnson is more of a liberal than anything else. He's I know he's a Brexiteer, but he's not a long way off being a hardline Tory. And so yes, he got ill and it's taken some weeks for him to recover, but now that he's back in the seat, I see him driving things ahead, and he's definitely a man that wants to build infrastructure. That's a key thing for him. And
yeah, he wanted to build a bridge. He wanted to build a bridge to Ireland, didn't he? Did he say that recently? I think he did. And a bridge to France. He wanted to build a bridge everywhere.
Why not? Yeah. I've asked about tunnelling to Ireland over the years, because being a mining engineer, we like the idea of digging tunnels. But apparently there's quite a lot of unexploded ordnance in the water down there. Yeah. There may be issues to do with that on bridge building, but why not? This is the time to get out there and build these sorts of projects. Let's not have lots of statues of Boris and Stalin or anything like that. Let's have real infrastructure that does real things, rather than some of the token projects that have been built by the European Union around the place. But if you travel around Europe, there are some magnificent roads going, you know, connecting Austria and Germany into Eastern Europe, and you know, built with EU money, and hopefully creating good economic growth.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Just finally, because we've been rabbiting on for ages, but I mean, I remember my father saying when his father suffered from the Great Depression and everything went down in the 1920s, in the valleys of Wales, it was really desperate and there was no workaround and all that stuff. But he said, you know, what you needed was confidence and stimulation. And even if the government had come to the valleys, there you are, here's £1 million, which back in those days would be huge, dig a hole, fill it back in, dig it again, we'll pay you. Even if you'd done that, you know, it'd get people out of bed in the morning, get them spending the local economy, and it would stimulate. So, you know, you have to do something to stimulate. Now, if you start building useful things, of course, that's even better. But what is it? The stimulation has to be there to start off with, to get people spending in the local economy to stimulate everything. You understand? So it's got to be done, isn't it? You know.
Well, but there is a very long list of really worthwhile construction projects that need to be done in the UK. Yeah. There's no shortage of things, of roads to repair,
exactly,
bridges to rebuild, infrastructure to expand. If you think the M1 was the first motorway in the UK built in the 60s, doesn't feel like that long ago, but it was built for a fraction of the capacity that uses it these days. So, you know, there's loads of opportunities to say let's add extra lanes to these roads, let's widen the bridges, let's make everything better than it was, and let's get on with it.
Trouble is, you got the environmentalists getting in the way. Never mind, John. Thanks, that fella. We'll speak to you next weeky.
Look forward to it, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. It's Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals, down 1.4% to 6.9 pence. At four, Tiziana Life Sciences, 102 pence, that is, down 2%. At three, Aston Martin, down 1.96% to 67.5. At two, Cadence Minerals, 7.47% up 11.15. And at number one, Razor, big chunk of change today, 45 million. Which is like, what is it, a quarter of their market cap, I think. It's Avacta Group. It's up 6.14% to 147. That's it for the podcast. No, it's not, actually. I'm lying there. Let me just go through some of the RNSs here. Top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, it is Angus Energy Operations and Planning Update. At four, Final Results and Notice of AGM, again, ACP, Armadale Capital, another company that don't put their name on the RNS. It's one of my bugbears. I have to click in there and see what it is. Metal Tiger, Vast Resources are the other two. At three, Tiziana Life Sciences, anti-CD3 for Alzheimer's disease. At two, Hummingbird Resources, earning agreement with ARX on Dugby Gold Project. And at one, it's Open Orphan, launch of COVID-19 antibody testing. They are down 2% on that. It's 14.15 pence, but they're launching that. It's really a sort of B2B thing. It's looking at employers and that. But launch of the COVID-19 anti-testing kit there, right there at Open Orphan. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.